This audio download is Martha Acklesberg speaking about the experiences of Spanish anarchist women during the Spanish Revolution of the 1930s. It was recorded at the 2009 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You can download more audio from www.wsm.ie.
Hi everybody, I'd like to welcome you all here today and thank you very much for coming. I'd also like to extend a warm welcome to Martha. She travelled a long way to be with us here today. And so thanks very much for coming, Martha. We really appreciate it. Martha is a long-time feminist activist who's been involved in anarchist politics for many years. Her academic work has concentrated on the nature and structure of political communities, in particular the passions of power and participation within them. Martha is the author of many political works, including probably her most celebrated book, Free Women of Spain, Anarchism and the Struggle for the Emancipation of Women, which has been translated into many languages. I just got her to sign my copy, so I'm very proud of that. Martha has written extensively about the anarchist movement in Spain and has focused in particular on the role of women within the anarchist project. Martha is going to be talking to us here today about the experiences of the Spanish Revolution and hopefully suggesting a few lessons that we can take from the experiences and maybe adapt to our struggle today. So again, I'd like you all to join in and welcoming Martha to the platform. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a real treat for me to be here. I've never been in Ireland before. I've always wanted to come, and so I've very much enjoyed the time. It's very weird speaking and not being able to see anyone, but I've really enjoyed the time that I've had so far. Looking forward to another week or so of touring around, and so I really thank you for giving me this opportunity and getting a chance to hear what's going on here and learning more about the struggles in Ireland. I want to talk now about an actual anarchist movement in Spain that involved tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people in the 1930s. Some of you, I gather, probably saw the film last night, which I haven't seen, I'm sorry to say, but about the experience of a woman apparently in the Spanish Revolution. But I want to tell you some about that that experience and make some suggestions, I hope, about what we can learn from their experiences. So in 1936, groups of women in Madrid and Barcelona in Spain founded an organization called Mujeres Libres, which means free women, which was dedicated to the liberation of women from what they understood as their triple enslavement to ignorance, as women, and as producers. It lasted for less than 3 years. Its activities in Spain were brought to an abrupt halt by the victory of Franco's forces in February of 1939. But during that time, Mujeres Libres mobilized over 20,000 women, developed an extensive network of activities designed to empower individual women while building a sense of community. And like the Spanish anarcho-syndicalist movement in which these women were rooted, Mujeres Libres insisted that the full development of women's individuality was dependent upon the development of a strong sense of connection with others. This is sort of another version of the community-based strategy that Ashanti was mentioning earlier. Those who established Mujeres Libres were deeply committed to that larger anarcho-syndicalist movement and its goals. But they found the existing organizations of the movement inadequate to address the specific problems confronting them as women, whether in the movement itself or in the larger society. They came to believe that a separate organization devoted to women's emancipation, to freeing women from that triple enslavement, was essential both to women and to the success of the larger anarcho-syndicalist movement. So what I want to do today is to talk about Mujeres Libres in the context of that Spanish movement, what its offer, what its limits were, and why, in that case at least, women thought it absolutely necessary to create an autonomous women's organization, and then how those efforts were received within the context of the larger movement. Now, as most of you probably know, anarchism aims to abolish hierarchy and structured relations of domination and subordination in society, and to create a society based on equality, mutuality, and reciprocity, in which each person is valued and respected as an individual. That social vision is combined with a theory of social change that insists that means must be consistent with ends, and that people cannot be directed into a future society, but must create it themselves, and in the process, recognize their own abilities and capacities. That's what Ashanti was referring to before as a kind of prefigurative politics, that one creates and lives in the society one is trying to build. In addition, some 19th century anarchist writers and activists, both in Spain and elsewhere, specifically addressed themselves to the subordination of women in their societies. They insisted that full human emancipation required not just the abolition of capitalism and of authoritarian political institutions, but the overcoming of women's cultural and economic subordination, both within and outside the home. So as early as 1872, for example, an anarchist congress in Zaragoza, Spain, declared that women ought to be fully the equals of men in the home and in the workplace. But neither the theory of anarchism nor the practice of anarcho-syndicalism in Spain was, in fact, egalitarian in the full sense of the word. Although many writers seem to acknowledge the importance of women's emancipation to the anarchist project and the importance of women to the movement, few gave those concerns top priority. As was the case with socialist movements throughout Europe, many Spanish anarcho-syndicalists treated the issue of women's subordination as at best secondary to the emancipation of workers, a problem which would be resolved, as Marxists used to say, on the morrow of the revolution. So what I want to do is to try to give you some sense of how the framework of anarcho-syndicalism, and specifically in Spain, offered the promise of fully integrating a concern with the subordination of women into a theory of radical social transformation, but also the ambiguities and the failures, the ways that despite the apparent awareness at the core of anarchist theory that relations of domination were manifold and complex, attention to the subordination of women was repeatedly given lower priority than the oppression of male workers, and to look at how the women of Mujeres Libres addressed the challenges posed by that situation. So let me begin by offering a brief overview of that anarcho-syndicalist understanding of oppression and subordination so that you'll understand the context within which Mujeres Libres in particular was operating. So first, as I mentioned before, it was a theory of society and social change that aims for a non-hierarchical, egalitarian society to be organized in communalist, voluntarist fashion. They rejected domination in all its forms and looked toward a society characterized by mutual respect and reciprocity. But this was not an individualist, liberal individualist understanding of freedom, but rather one that operated from the assumption that freedom was a social product. Freedom could be achieved only through social struggle and change. As did Marxists, the Spanish anarcho-syndicalists also recognized that economic organization, structures of power and dominance based on control over the means of production, was an important source of power and inequality. They agreed with Marx that those relationships of power and domination dehumanize both the powerful and the relatively powerless. The powerful come to see themselves as absolutely essential, and the powerless come to doubt their own capacities and powers. But they also agreed and insisted that the only way out of such relationships is through the self-organization of those who are subordinated. The process of organizing and struggling collectively changes people's perceptions of themselves, precisely the ways that Ashanti was talking about before, It raises consciousness, it empowers, and it enables people to create a new reality. But they also differed with Marxist socialists on a number of important points. They did not privilege economics or class in the way that Marx had. The tendency toward power and domination, they insisted, existed and had to be addressed, even independent of economic structures. And therefore, they insisted on confronting all forms of hierarchically structured power, not just that based in economic relations. And in Spain, of course, one of the very important structures of power, in addition to the economy and the state, was the church. So they were very aware of the power of the church as an institution. Most importantly for my purposes and our purposes here, I think, there was an insistence on the relationship between means and ends. Recognized, I think, by Marx, but not always followed through by many of Marx's followers. You cannot create an egalitarian society, they insisted, by authoritarian, inegalitarian means. Why not? Since existing society reinforces a sense of powerlessness, people need to come to a sense of their own power and capacities if they are ever going to be able to participate as fully equal members of a new revolutionary egalitarian society. And how do you come to a sense of your own capacities and powers in a society that is dedicated and designed to repress our knowledge of that? Through the revolutionary process itself, which has to create an egalitarian society through its own practices. Revolutionary practice, that is, has to grow from the ground up, beginning with people's daily lives, whether in union movements or in neighborhood forms of resistance. And at the same time, perhaps a bit paradoxically, as Enriqueta Rovira, who was a member of Mujeres Libres, one of the people that I had the privilege to interview over the course of the years I was working on this book, you can't improvise a revolution. You have to prepare for it. So what did that mean in the Spanish context? I've got some images here. I want to try to see if I can put up so you... Okay, so one thing it means is direct action. Revolutionary activity must begin where people are, not through intermediaries like political parties, and they must be activities which change the realities in which people live, the kind of community-based organizing that Ashanti was talking about the Panthers engaging in and aiming for. In Spain, that took a number of forms. First, and probably predominantly union organizing and workplace-based strikes, anarchist organizing began in Spain as early as the 1870s. But another very important form, and it was important because it engaged women and people who were not engaged in workplace in unions, in what was called quality of life protests and other forms of community-based struggles, rent strikes, food boycotts, and the like, that addressed ongoing daily needs and also changed people's consciousness of themselves and their possibilities. And there are parallels here, I think, to food collectives, bookshop collectives, women's health collectives, all of which we had certainly in the United States in the 70s, and I believe you certainly got some going here now and have had in the year renter squats, tenant organizing, and things of that sort. Critical here to this process was also education. Literacy was a critical component of almost all anarchist programs in Spain starting from the 1870s because they believed that illiteracy really separated people from their ability to learn about the world or to be confident in their ability to learn about the world. So education and literacy would lead to an improved sense of self and a greater ability to gain information about the world. In Spain, rationalist schools and what were an Ateneo's kind of storefront cultural centers began to be created in the early years of the 20th century. Some of these were designed for adults and run by unions. Some of them met during the day. Many of them worked operated at night and on weekends so that people who were working full-time would still be able to go and learn. And also programs for children, again with... with the goal of empowerment. These are three people. It's a little bit dark, but I wanted to, this is up just for the woman in the middle, Cristina Piera, who was in her 90s at the time this was taken. Those were her two sons, Rogelio and Enrique Casañas. Cristina had the fortune to be part of a very early rationalist school run by Francisco Ferrer, who was a very important activist and educator in Spain and was executed by the Spanish government in 1909, partly for doing things like running schools that would teach workers how to read and learn about the world. And she was one of his students. So the movement in Spain developed an extensive array of cultural centers, youth groups, drama groups, outdoor and informal activities of a variety of sorts that would lead to what they understood as enculturation, literacy, a sense of what, in the U.S. context, Martin Luther King Jr. referred to as a sense of somebody-ness, a belief that one had the ability to understand and make a difference in the world. These sorts of activities, particularly those connected to cultural and literacy programs, were a kind of signature element of anarchist organizing in both rural and urban areas in Spain in the years leading up to the Spanish Civil War. Now, as I mentioned, anarchists in general were critical of hierarchies. Some actually used the example of the existing subordination of women in Spanish society to illustrate claims about the disempowering effects of hierarchical structures and to demonstrate the power of social institutions to create dependent persons. As early as 1903, for example, José Prat argued that women's backwardness is a consequence of the way she has been and still is treated. Nature, he went on to say, has nothing to do with this. If woman is backward, it is because in all times man has kept her inferior, depriving her of all those rights which he was gradually winning for himself. But the fact that he and other writers pointed to the situation of women to illustrate the dangers of relationships of domination and subordination, and even to explain women's own subordination within the Spanish context, did not necessarily mean that the movement as a whole was committed to the liberation of women as a top priority. In fact, people in the movement were divided, both about the appropriate place of women in working class organizations and about the nature of women's subordination and of what would be necessary to overcome it. Most anarchist writers seem to agree that women were severely disadvantaged in Spanish society and that existing inequalities between men and women were largely the product of social conditioning and male power. But there were two differing streams of thought about the nature of male-female relationships that developed among Spanish anarchists during the course of the 19th and early 20th century. One stream, which had its roots in the French anarchist theorist Proudhon, said that women essentially are reproducers who make their contribution to society in and through their role in the home. According to this view, what was necessary for women's emancipation was the revaluation of women's work in the home and an acknowledgement that her work outside the home would always be secondary to that of men. And then there was a second stream, which was more similar to a kind of Marxist perspective and had its roots in the writings of the Russian anarchist Bakunin, that women were the equals of men, and that the key to women's emancipation would be their full incorporation into the paid labor force on terms equal with men. If women were to overcome their secondary status in Spanish society, they would have to join the labor force as workers and struggle in unions to improve the position of all workers. Now, the official position of the CNT, the Confederación Nacional del Trabajo, the National Confederation of Labor, the Anarcho-Syndicalist Union, followed this second view, but that was no guarantee that the majority of its members actually would act in accordance with that commitment. In fact, the practice of the movement rarely lived up to its stated beliefs in this regard. There was, however, a third view, held mostly but not only by women, that organizing women into unions, even if it were possible to do so, would not in itself be sufficient. That the sources of women's subordination were broader and deeper than economic exploitation at the workplace, that women's subordination was as much a cultural as an economic phenomenon, and reflected a devaluation of women and their activities mediated through institutions such as family and church. Further, at least some located women's subordination in her reproductive role and in the double standard of sexual morality. These too would have to change through the adoption of a new sexual morality and the widespread use of birth control if women were to be fully equal partners in a revolutionary society. As one woman who was engaged with Mujeres Libres and became a historian of the movement said, all of those compañeros, however radical they may be in cafes, in unions, and even affinity groups, seem to drop their costumes as lovers of female liberation at the doors of their homes. Inside, they behave with their compañeras just as common husbands. Most activist women reported that their male colleagues, whether at union meetings, in youth groups, or in cultural centers, did not always treat them with respect. What happened to my picture of Enriqueta? I missed her. All right. Can we go back? Okay. I had a picture of this woman's sister, but somehow or another it got lost. Anyway, Enriqueta Rovira once reported saying to her comrades who were involved in the youth movement and these cultural centers, it's true that we have struggled together, but you are always the leaders and we are always the followers. Whether in the streets or at home, we are little better than slaves. Women who were active members of unions or who participated in these cultural centers or in anarchist youth groups were always a minority, and it was hard to get other women involved. Either, they said, because of the sexism of the men, sometimes because of the diffidence of the women, or most likely because of some combination of the two. Let me tell you a few of their stories that may help recall a little bit of the atmosphere of the time. Azucena Fernandez Barba, the woman whose photo you see up there, had two parents who were deeply committed to the anarchist movement. She was one of seven children. She had five sisters and a brother, and they were all involved in the movement in one way or another. She and her siblings helped found a storefront cultural center called Sol y Vida, Sun and Life in Barcelona. But as she reported her experiences, inside their homes, men forgot completely about women's struggle. It's the same, she said, to use an analogy, as a man who is obsessed with playing cards. They go out to play cards. They do it regardless of what's going on in the house. The same with us, only it wasn't cards, but ideas. They struggled, they went out on strike, but inside the house, worse than nothing. I think we should have set an example with our own lives, lived differently in accordance with what we said we wanted. But no, for them, meaning the men in the movement, the struggle was outside. Inside the house, our desires, women's desires, were purely utopian. Pepita Carpena, another woman who became involved in Mujeres Libres, who was long involved with the anarcho-syndicalist unions and the youth movement in Barcelona, described one of her experiences with a compañero from the youth movement, which is one of my favorite stories. So I'm going to, it's a little bit long, but I'll want to tell it to you because she was such a great character. I'll tell you a story, she said to me, because for me, what has always been my saving grace is that I'm very outgoing, and I'm not bashful about responding to people who give me a hard time. One time, a compañero from the Juventudes, the youth movement, came over to me and said, you who say you're so liberated, you're not so liberated. Because if I would ask me to give you a kiss, you wouldn't. I suspect that a variety of women who have been involved in left movements have had similar experiences. I just stood there staring at him and thinking to myself, now how am I going to get out of this one? And then I said to him, listen, when I want to go to bed with a guy, I'm the one that has to choose him. I don't go to bed with just anyone. You don't interest me as a man. I don't feel anything for you. Why should you want me to liberate myself, as you put it, by going to bed with you? That's no liberation for me. That's just making love simply for the sake of making love. No, I said to him, love is something that has to be like eating. If you're hungry, you eat. And if you want to go to bed with a guy, then... Besides, I'm going to tell you something else. Perhaps you'll get angry at me. And then she turned and she said, I did this just to kind of get at him, you know. Perhaps you'll get angry at me, but your mouth doesn't appeal to me. And I don't like to make love with a guy without kissing him. He was left speechless. But I did it with a dual purpose in mind, because I wanted to show him that that's not the way to educate compañeras. And that's what the struggle of women was like in Spain, even with men from our own group. And I'm not talking about what it was like with other guys. The claim that the concern with male-female equality did not carry over well into intimate personal relationships was widespread among the women I spoke with. But what bothered many of them equally was that many men did not seem to take women seriously, even in more public or political contexts. The woman on the right here is Pura Pérez Arcos, and this was her friend Encarnacion. She also was involved in Mujeres Libres. This was a picture more or less from the time. She attended a rationalist school in Barcelona also, enjoyed the youth movement there. But notice that when girls went to meetings of the youth movement, the boys would often laugh at them even before they got up to speak. These reflected some of the variety of views on women's proper place in society and in the movement that had developed over time within the Spanish anarchist movement. But despite the official commitment to the equality of women, the anarcho-syndicalist movement rarely took the organization of women workers seriously, if it attended to it at all. It tended to see women as helpmates rather than as active, full-fledged revolutionaries. And although women were actively involved in unions in the late 19th and early 20th century, and even constituted a majority of members in many textile union locals, they were rarely represented in the leadership. So the practice of anarcho-syndicalist unions tended to lag rather far behind its ideological commitment to women's inclusion on an equal basis with men. So in this context, roughly between 1934 and 1936, groups of women activists began to discuss the specific subordination of women within the movement and ways to organize to address it. Oh, this is Enriqueta. How she got there, I don't know. This is the sister of Lucena, another one of those seven anarchist siblings who told me the story that although her parents were committed anarchists, they still had very proper ideas about how women should behave. So when she wanted to go off with the youth movement, youth groups for trips into the countryside, she would have to put a skirt on over her shorts, go off on the bicycle, and then take off the skirt so that she could go off with her friends, even from an anarchist household. Okay, this is Soledad Serrat from Barcelona, a group called the Grupo Cultural Femenino, began to form in Barcelona in 1934. It brought together women who were involved in anarcho-syndicalist unions to foster a sense of solidarity and to enable them to take more active roles both in the union and in the movement. As she described to me, in Catalonia at least, the dominant position within the movement was that men and women should both be involved. But the problem was the men didn't know how to get women involved as activists. Both men and most women thought of women in a secondary status. For most men, I think, the ideal situation would be to have a compañera who did not oppose their ideas, but in whose private life would be more or less like other women. They wanted to be activists 24 hours a day. And in that context, of course, it's impossible to have equality. Men got so involved that the women were left behind almost of necessity, especially, for example, when the men would be taken to jail. Then she would have to take care of the children, work to support the family, visit him in jail, and all that stuff. That the compañeras were very good at. But for us, that was not enough. That was not activism. That was not equality. These are three other women. Sara Berenguer, Amala Dano, and Conchita Guillén, all of whom also were involved in Mujeres Libres in the Barcelona area. In Madrid, roughly at the same time, in the years before the Civil War, Lucia Sanchez Ornil, who was a writer and a poet, and Mercedes Coma Posada, who was a lawyer, undertook similar efforts. And eventually, the groups heard of one another's existence. People met and they started working together. And what they aimed to do was to explore the specific subordination of women in capitalist society, and to do so in an atmosphere that would take women, their lives and experiences and hopes, seriously. So let me now talk a little bit more about what they did programmatically and organizationally, and how they understood the importance of autonomy to their struggle. First, let me say that it's important to note that they did not define themselves as feminists, by which they meant those who focused on education and professional jobs. These issues had long been of concern to middle-class feminists, of which there was a movement in Spain, but had been rejected by anarchists as irrelevant to the lives of working-class people, women as well as men. So Suceso Portales, who was another woman who was involved in Mujeres Libres, more from the Madrid area, once explained to me, we aren't and we weren't feminists, those who, in her view, were fighting against men. We didn't want to substitute a feminine hierarchy for a masculine hierarchy. It's interesting to me that that's the way they understood what feminism was about. It was essential that we work and struggle together, because otherwise there would be no social revolution. But we needed our own organization to fight for ourselves. Or as Soledad explained to me, most of us had never heard of feminism before. I didn't know that there were groups of women out there in the world organizing for women's rights. There were some one or two within our group who had heard of feminism. They had been to France. But I didn't know that such things even existed in the world. We didn't import this from elsewhere. We hadn't even realized it existed. Why a group just for women within the context of an anarchist movement that was supposedly committed to equality for women? Not because they didn't trust men, and not because at least some of the men were not ready to commit themselves to women's equality, but because of their anarchist-based commitment to direct action. Only through their own autonomous, self-directed actions would women come to recognize their own capacities. As Lucia Sanchez Ornil wrote in 1935, it is not he, the male compañero, who is called upon to set out the roles and responsibilities of the woman in society, no matter how elevated he might consider them to be. No, the anarchist way is to allow the woman to act freely herself, without tutors or external pressures, that she may develop in the direction that her nature and her faculties dictate. So during those early months in moving into 1936, the groups engaged in a combination of consciousness raising and direct action. They created networks of women anarchists who attempted to meet the need for mutual support in union and other movement contexts. They attended meetings with one another, checking out reports of chauvinist behavior on the part of their male comrades and strategizing about how to deal with it. The Barcelona group established what they referred to as guarderías volantes, flying daycare centers. In their efforts, for example, to involve more women in union activities, they had met repeatedly with the claim that women's childcare responsibilities prevented them from from either staying late at work or going out at night to participate in meetings. So they decided to address this problem by going to the homes of these people who were would-be union activists and caring for their children while the women went out to serve as union delegates. Then in July 1936, the Civil War began with an attempted coup d'etat that was repulsed, at least in some of the major cities, by a combination of organized armed civilians, many of them union-based, and some loyal military. For those of you who are not familiar with this, let me just say a little bit about that context. In February 1936, a Popular Front government was elected, which was a coalition of center and left parties, and that led to increasing demands for land reform, release of political prisoners, and improved working conditions on the part of workers, and growing fear and attempted coups on the part of the right. On July 18th, the coup took place, led by four generals, including Francisco Franco. And on July 19th, the day after the coup, the military rising, there were popular uprisings in many cities, including raids on armories that prevented the rebels, who were allied with the military and the church and large landowners and large industrialists, from taking over. This provided the context for a broad-based social revolution, the likes of which had not really been seen in Europe or really, I think, anyplace else. Popular militias replaced the army. Workers collectivized factories abandoned by their owners. Agricultural workers took over many farms and estates, again, especially those abandoned by their owners. And many municipalities were also collectivized and run by elected groups of working people. All of this built on 70 prior years of anarchist and socialist organizing in Spain. It's an incredible story that we could talk about later if folks want to. Meanwhile, in August, United States, Britain, France, Italy, and Germany signed what was referred to as a non-intervention treaty, although Italy and Germany announced at the time they signed it that they would not abide by it. All of those countries said that they would not intervene in the war and they would not supply arms to either side. Germany and Italy, of course, supplied soldiers and war material to the Franco side, and probably one of the most famous consequences of that was the bombing of Guernica by the Luftwaffe. The only countries to support the legally elected government in Spain were Mexico and the USSR, which led to increasing international isolation of the Republic and within the Republican field, increasing power of the Communist Party because the Soviet Union was the only one supporting them. And it's also important to know in this context that the Soviets played a counter-revolutionary role in Spain. Stalin was trying to build a kind of Popular Front alliance, hope to get to break down the fears of the U.S., Britain, and France vis-a-vis the Russians, and so he and the Communist Party in Spain tried to play down, not just play down, but crush the social revolution. So in this context, Mujeres Libres developed two sets of goals. One was called Capacitación and the other Captación. Capacitación means roughly empowerment, coming to an awareness of and acting on one's capacities and abilities. This was the essence of virtually all of their programs, and it was clearly derived from long-standing anarchist commitment to preparation and direct action. So they sponsored education and literacy programs at all levels, employment and apprenticeship programs. You see a few examples of that here. These are women working in the fields on the left, and Casa de Maternidad, a maternity hospital that Mujeres Libres organized there on the right. They worked together with unions to develop apprenticeship programs. They saw women's employment as critical to their emancipation, not, as did socialists and communists, just a temporary response to wartime labor shortages, but something that women should be engaged in then and continuing forward. They developed consciousness-raising groups to help women in unions and in workplaces to find their own voices and struggle for their needs. They sponsored many programs for education and support around motherhood and child rearing, education around sexuality, birth control, anti-prostitution, and opposition to the sexual double standard. These are some more wonderful. This is Dolores Prat, who was very involved in union organizing in her town, part of Barcelona. These are two examples of the magazine Mujeres Libres, which was part of their cultural work. They published 14 issues of this magazine, 13 of them during the war itself. They had an extensive program of publications, including books, informational pamphlets, a radio program, and public speaking programs. And this was one of their major programs. They had a goal of creating liberatorios de prostitución, things that would enable women to leave prostitution and be trained for other kinds of activities. They saw prostitution as a consequence of women's subordination and women's ignorance and the unavailability of other ways to support themselves. So they appealed to women to and provided opportunities for women to be trained in other professions, and they appealed to men not to visit. Not to visit houses of prostitution. The second major stream of their activities were what was referred to as captación, mobilizing women into the libertarian rather than the communist socialist movement, which became of ever increasing importance as the war went on and the power of the Communist Party increased. And they tried to explain themselves to their male comrades as to why they needed a separate organization. And they said, "We are aware of the precedents set by both feminist organizations," meaning bourgeois feminist organizations, "and by political parties. We could not follow either of these paths. We could not separate the women's problem from the social problem, nor could we deny the significance of the first, women's subordination, by converting women into a simple instrument for any organization, even our own libertarian organization. The intention that underlay our activities was much, much broader, to serve a doctrine, not a party, to empower women, to make of them individuals capable of contributing to the structuring of a future society, individuals who have learned to be self-determining, not to follow blindly the dictates of any organization." In their view, organizational autonomy was critical. Women needed a separate organization because it would be only through their own self-directed action that they could come to see themselves as capable and competent. And only through that would men come to recognize the women as equal partners. This particular goal of having a separate organization recognized as a fully equal member of the larger libertarian movement never was accepted by the majority of male anarchists or by the movement, which saw them as somehow separatist and separating themselves rather than as trying to organize independently within that larger context. The idea of a separate women's organization that would create and run its own programs was clearly deeply threatening to that larger movement. And the response of Mujeres Libres was to argue that neither anarchism nor syndicalism were the exclusive province of men. As compañeras, they insisted, they had their own responsibility to engage in empowerment and direct action. It cannot be claimed, they insisted, in opposition to our own self-determination and autonomy, that anarchism admits of no difference between the sexes, because then it would be necessary to acknowledge that our supposedly libertarian organizations are no such thing, because, whether deliberately or accidentally, they consist almost entirely and exclusively of men. So you can't have it both ways. If you're not going to allow us to organize independently, then how do you explain the fact that there are almost no women in your organization? Their struggles were never fully understood or appreciated, and I think that their experiences were and have been, alas, echoed by women involved in radical movements in many places around the world. They demanded that a new society and efforts to create it include women as well as men. Practically, they insisted that the movement treat women equally with men, while at the same time respecting women's differences from men. Not an easy task, or one that we in our generation aren't necessarily any much better at, and I think that's some of the same kind of issues that Ashanti has referred to a little bit in his talk, but more in other things of his that I've seen. This perspective, I believe, was Mujeres Libres' unique contribution to the development of the libertarian movement in Spain, and I would argue more widely. And at the same time, it was that which posed the greatest challenges for it. Despite the difficulties they had, it's important to recognize what they accomplished even in the midst of civil war. They acted on the basis of understandings about the situation of women in society that were advanced, even I would say revolutionary, not just for their own time, but for ours. They conceived of the emancipation of women as an integral part of human emancipation. They struggled hard to work toward that end in the context of a broad social movement. It required them to confront their own comrades and organizations at the same time that they were trying to work with them. And these are not now, nor were they then, of course, easy goals to achieve. Second, they offered a truly important vision of the emancipation of women that was not about women's conquest of power, whether that be economic, political, or social, but that was itself a profound critique of hierarchy and structures of power overall. They insisted that striving for privileges for some will always leave on the margins others who are disprivileged. Today, we can talk about the unemployed, the immigrants, the underemployed, gay people, people of color, you name it, whatever, there are always marginalized people in a structure of hierarchical power. The goal then for them, as one woman put it, was una sociedad más justa, más humana para todos. A society that is more just, more human for everyone. And they insisted that if such a goal is to be achieved, women must work for it together with men. Third, and very much related to this, they recognized the importance of diversity, of variety, of differences among people. And they put forward a vision of social transformation in which different groups would be included in and with their differences. They were not trying to make everyone the same. And they insisted that true freedom, emancipation in the full sense of the word, is to be achieved only in community and through social collective struggle. I want to end with one of Mujeres Libres' calls to women in Spain at the time. Do you live in a village where women are relegated to a life of obscurity and insignificance, considered little more than things, dedicated exclusively to the home, to the care of home and family? Undoubtedly, many times you have found yourself disgusted with this. And when you have witnessed the freedom that your brothers and the men of your household exercise, you have felt sorrow at the plight of women. Well, against all that you have had to suffer, against all this comes Mujeres Libres. We want you to have the same freedom as your brothers. We want your voice to be heard with the same respect as that of your father. We want you to achieve that independent life that you sometimes imagine for yourself. Now remember, all this will require work from you. These goals will not be achieved simply by wanting them. You will need the help, the collective efforts of other compañeras. You will need others to be interested in the same things as you. They will need to help you and you to help them. In one word, you will need to work together in community. Not a bad vision, I say, even for our own day. Thank you.
Thank you, Marta, for that very inspirational talk. Kind of says a lot about the importance of working together within our own organisations and never really getting too complacent about the feminist movement. We're now going to take questions from the floor. We'll take them in threes, and then Martha will answer them. Is that okay?
Sure.
Thanks.
I was just wondering, like, with all of those women that you would have interviewed for the book Mujeres Libres, what were their experiences sort of after the Spanish Civil War? What other stuff would they have been involved in after, like the stuff you would have read about in the book?
How dangerous would you consider, say, liberal feminism as a form of pseudo-liberation? I think that feminism is inherently tied to the left-wing ideology, and liberal feminism poses a real threat.
Yeah, following on to the last question, there is a distinction, I think, between liberal feminism and bourgeois feminism.
I'm sorry.
And bourgeois feminism. Bourgeois feminism tends to take over at the long terms and election wins. Probably the greatest tragedy to the feminist movement was when they were fighting for the vote for women. You had a split, and especially among the Parkhurst sisters, where you had Emily and Emily was the mother, and Isabel was one of the daughters. They went into an absolute right-wing charade where they were building castles and they were attacking wolves of art and all that sort of thing. And Christabel, her sister, led the working class in the working class areas of London. She opposed all of that. In the end, Christabel and Emily actually came back to Britain at the outbreak of the First World War. They lined up with another one of the militants, a woman called Ellen Smith, and they met Lloyd George. And they said to Lloyd George that they were prepared to come to recruit the surgeons for the British Army in the First World War. And he said, in that case, he says, you should go around, put a little white flush in any male you see who is not in uniform, and call him a coward. And then I can guarantee you that it's a vote for women. And he did. But even then, he didn't give them universal suffrage. He gave them suffrage from a 20 years of age, as opposed to men that getting them at 21. Now, the bourgeois feminists, even in the second stage, where they begin very, very correctly, they're pushing the particularly important change for women, and in the end, they end up in reinforcements for the establishment. I mean, this paper, the first Jewish feminist, it's not a person.
Marriage, though,
it's not a person process, and I don't think call feminism for heads. It's just a bit, I'm not for feminism, but I'm not for political feminism. So I think that's
Okay, let me try to respond to these in order. First of all, the after-war experiences of these women. Most of the people that I interviewed, with a few exceptions, went into exile at the end of the war. There were a couple of people I interviewed who stayed in Spain. They had really, really tough time. There was a very, very severe repression. They spent many, many years in jail. Lived in abject poverty, and I was actually thinking when Ashanti was talking before about the loss of the history, the Panthers not passing that on, former Panthers not passing that on to their children, and people in the community more generally not telling the children what had happened. When I first went to Spain, the first time I went was in 1976 when Franco was still alive, or actually he was dying. Which, as you probably remember, he did for a long time. But when I went back in 1979, Franco had been dead for 3 years, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. There'll all these people come back. They'll want be eager to tell their stories. The people be, you know, after 40 years of having to keep quiet, 40 years of having to keep quiet, they'll be eager to tell their stories. And people who had stayed in Spain in particular, petrified. None of them told their children anything they had done because they were afraid that they would be thrown in jail. Even when I went back 10 years after that and talked about what I had found, I found a whole generation of Spanish young people who knew nothing about the social revolution of the Civil War. All they knew was the Franco story of the Civil War, that they needed this military coup because the anarchists had thrown the whole country into chaos. So you had, you know, a generation and a half at least of people who had lost their history. But the people, those who went into exile, had a very different experience. Most of them, many, many of them lived in southern France. Some in Paris, others went to Mexico, some to Canada, a few to England. In the immediate aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, this was another one of these terrible stories in Western European world history. The people who had been fighting Franco went across the border in 1939, right before the outbreak, right, of World War II. They thought that they would be greeted by the French as the first fighters against fascism, and they were thrown into concentration camps in southern France. And most of them got out only when they joined the partisans to fight the Nazis during World War II. But others, you know, by the end of, they joined unions in France, they became involved in French left organizations of one sort or another. Many of them continued to be involved with comrades in anarchist organizations in southern France and in the Paris area. And actually, when I interviewed a number of these women in southern France in the 1970s and 80s, they told me very proudly that their children had all been involved in left politics in France, mostly socialist, because there wasn't an anarchist movement. But, you know, they were willing to take that. It was their children had not rebelled against them. They had really continued along the same path. So, interestingly enough, the people who went into exile were able to have a life that was much more continuous with the values that they had lived in Spain than the people who stayed in Spain, who had a very, very hard time during those years. Liberal feminism. What can I say? I agree with most of what, the critiques. I think one of my main frustrations in the United States is that the feminism that people know there is liberal feminism, which is not the feminism that I and most of my comrades were involved in when we were getting started in the late 60s and early 70s, which was, you know, not get a piece of the pie, but make a whole new pie. You know, get rid of the boardrooms. Don't try to get into the boardrooms. You know, there was a wonderful book by Barbara. A British women's historian about the origins of the joint origins of feminism and socialism in the 1830s and 40s, and that one of the things that was really tragic for both movements was the split. And socialism kind of went off and left the women question behind, and the kind of liberal feminist movement went off and left the social question behind. And I think both movements suffered. Both movements were limited as a result of that. And, you know, I think the feminist question is a really difficult one because there's probably a lot of radical, socialist, anarchist, anti-capitalist, feminist activity going on, I suspect here, England, the U.S. and elsewhere. But what gets publicized is what the media picks up. And what does it pick up? Liberal feminism, right? Because it sort of fits with the structures of power and authority. So it's sometimes it's very difficult to know what's going on. And it's important, again, if we think back to the film clips we saw earlier in the day, not to be taken over by the images of our culture and the images of ourselves that the culture is trying to get us to attention to.
We're actually running out of time, so can we take one more question from the floor, probably from Amy, perhaps, and then...
one thing that really struck me from the book is how young the women were. They were girls, really, they were 13 and 14. So I wondered, could you tell me, did they tell you how they first got involved in politics at that age? And also, can you maybe tell me a little bit about how they actually organized among themselves, what sort of structures they had?
So many of these women were very young. They weren't quite 13 or 14. They were more 15, 16, 17. Part of the reason for that, I think, was that by the time I was interviewing people, I mean, these women were already in their 60s by the time I was interviewing them, because we're talking about a 40-year gap. So people who were older at the time that the movement took off, many of them were already dead by the time I began. So it gave me, we have to remember, there's a somewhat skewed picture by virtue of the fact that there was a 40-year gap here. Although one of the people I interviewed was Mercedes Comas Posada, who was one of the founders, and she was in her late 80s, actually, at the time that I interviewed her. She was already in her 30s at the time of the founding of the Civil War. So a lot of the people... Well, there were two groups. Some of them came from anarchist families, like Azucena and Enriqueta, Sara Berenguer, a number of those people. Their parents were anarchists, so they had some access. Some of them, and they got involved first through the anarchist youth movement. And it was their experiences in the youth movement where they were not treated as equals that led them to think about, well, let's get together with other women and see if we can do something about this. But then you also had people like Pepita Carpena and Soledad Serac, who did not come from anarchist families. Soledad had a father who was a teacher, I think, and was kind of progressive in his politics, but her mother's family was quite conservative. Her father died when she was relatively young, and so she had this kind of progressive piece from him that she wasn't able to act on in her small town and in her home. So as soon as she was able to, at about 15 or 16, she left home, went to work as a domestic in Barcelona, was very badly treated there, but somehow or another, she heard about anarchists, and she told me this great story about how she saw some magazine, I think it was La Revista Blanca, that was published by Federica Monsen, this long-standing anarchist family, and Federica Monsen became an anarchist minister, actually, in the Civil War government. And she thought, well, maybe those people would have something for me. So she actually went to the offices of La Revista Blanca and met with Federica Monsen and said, you know, how do I join? And Federica was not of the arm-open welcoming type. And she sort of, you know, didn't know what to do with her. But there was some older guy there who kind of took her under his wing and, as she described it, opened the world to her. And Pepita had a similar kind of experience. She went to a union meeting, and while a lot of the guys were kind of ridiculing her and making fun of her, there was one older man there who kind of was intrigued by the fact that there was this 15, 16-year-old girl who was interested, and he kind of took her under his wing and took her. She had to sneak out of her house any time she wanted to go to a union meeting. Her parents were kind of right-wingers and didn't approve of any of the stuff. But this guy kind of became a second father, almost like a grandfather to her, and helped her out. So for a lot of people, there were, you know, there was one man. Often it was a man because they didn't have women who were ahead of them in the organizations who kind of helped them find their way in. And then once they were there, they were able to find one another, and they started. I think, you know, as Soledad described it in Barcelona, they called themselves Grupo Cultural Femenino, so the women's cultural group. They probably met, the closest thing we would have to it is a consciousness-raising group, I guess. They met, they saw themselves really as trying to talk together with one another to better understand their situation so that they could work together with one another in the organizations, whether it be the unions or the youth group, to try to forward the concerns of women and get other women involved. So that was one of their goals from the beginning, was not just to improve their situation, but to get more women involved so that together they could work and, you know, move toward changing a society that would become, and creating a society that would become more equal.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I think we could stay here all day and chat about this, but I think we want to show us in the venue. But so once again, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This audio download is Martha Acklesberg speaking about the experiences of Spanish anarchist women during the Spanish Revolution of the 1930s. It was recorded at the 2009 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You can download more audio from www.wsm.ie.